Welcome to The Great Humbling. I'm Dougal Tyne, co-founder of the Dog Mountain Project and A School Called Home. In the spring of 2020, I began recording these conversations with the poet and recovering sustainability consultant, Ed Gillespie. We call them The Great Humbling because this feels like a time of being humbled, brought down to earth and, if we're lucky, back into connection with land and soil and with each other. Thank you for listening. Well, here we are, Ed. It's the end of February. It's the end of our fifth series of these conversations, episode 8, series 5. Maybe it makes sense for us as we head into this episode to just try and pick up a few of the loose ends. I know that you're just back from Manchester. You told us a few weeks back about the Hard Art Collective and the fate of Britain. So, report back. Tell us, what is the fate of Britain?
Yes. As you'll recall, the fate of Britain is a wonderful pun, taking the village fate into something which sounds almost a bit more like a date with destiny. It was really extraordinary. I've been working alongside all of the Hard Art gang for over a year now, just over a year. And so this was the first proper manifestation, I guess, of what our collective work might look like together when it actually does a takeover of a major venue. And we had 4 days of, I guess, a celebration of collaboration and imagination. Is the way that it was kind of pitched, because you're bringing so many different diverse talents together, from people who are, you know, renowned artists and musicians and comedians, to people who've worked at the deep levels of deliberative democracies and citizens' assemblies. So it's how does that heady mix come together to address the big challenges of our time in a way that feels very different to the way it's been done conventionally. And so, it was incredibly moving. It was funny. It was inspiring. It felt like a big gathering of the clans. Inevitably, when you're doing a big collaborative piece like that and you know everyone who is involved in running a session, it was a bit like a sort of a wedding gathering, you know, where you're walking around going, oh, hello, lovely to see you. And everyone was involved in doing something. I mean, I did my game show. Mine was perhaps not the most serious contribution to proceedings. I did, you know, If This Is Democracy, Get Me Out of Here, as a bit of light relief, you know, early on Friday evening before the main comedy event.
Who did you have on your panel, Zed?
I had, so we had one team, which was Lee Jasper, who people might remember, you know, deep-rooted anti-racism campaigner, and was Ken Livingstone's special advisor on race and equality when he was mayor of London. And Lee was joined by Jennifer Reed, who is a street singer who specializes in 19th century Manchester and Lancastrian street song. These penny ballads or broadside ballads that would be like the social media of their day, basically sung in the street and then the lyrics printed off and sold for a penny. Who was the third member of their team? And Deza Gargi, who is one of the kind of youth founders of XR. And amazing, described by The Guardian, I think, as like a sort of bundle of warmth, energy and joy, which she genuinely is. And then on the other side, we had Claire Farrell, one of the co-founders of Grown Up XR, if that it's not the youth wing, the artist and musician Love Sega, who's well renowned for his campaigning on air quality, particularly in South London, and the way it disproportionately impacts, you know, black and minority ethnic communities there, and then the comedian Stuart Goldsmith, who is currently touring a show called Spoilers, which is doing that very difficult task of making climate change funny, and doing it with some aplomb.
So you were basically like in, I don't know, Stephen Fry or Angus Deaton, or this is showing how long it is since I've watched a TV game show, but the the role of the host here, conjuring playfulness out of contest.
Exactly that.
And there's been all sorts of other things going on, hasn't there? Because I heard from our friend Liz Slade, who's the chief officer of the Unitarian Church, that she'd been hosting a Sunday service yesterday afternoon at the venue with Brian Eno and his choir, and
yeah,
I believe Jarvis Cocker giving a sermon. So it's really been, it's been quite mixing it up in terms of the forms and the reference points and the voices.
Oh, definitely. It did work. I mean, I think it was so joyous. And actually, you know, you when you bring these things together, you realize where the alignments and overlaps and the synergies and interactions are. So whilst everyone had been working perhaps quite independently on developing their own particular sessions, because we've been also having conversations together for over a year, I think there was some deeper work in terms of our alignment and our sort of pointing in similar directions, which led to it feeling quite coherent. I mean, there's an extraordinary piece from Brian Eno upstairs, which is called Face to Face, which is a projection of a huge projection of an individual person's face, which I think was originally based on some original photographs, but then using some morphing software, basically each face would transform to another face pixel by pixel. Mm-hmm. So this gradual, very, very subtle, soft process of transformation, in effect, creating 170,000 new faces in between. And, you know, just that as an embodiment of connection and intimacy and solidarity was really quite moving.
And is there a question, is there anything you're coming away wondering about after these few days?
Yeah. I mean, I think, it like in all of these events, you know, when it's like a wedding, you know, there's always a question hanging, like, you know, who's the audience here? So I think because it was the first event of this collective, there was a slight sense of not preaching to the converted, but and perhaps literally in Liz's case, you know, singing with the choir, to the choir. but it's inevitable that there's a little sneaking suspicion to go, well, how much of, you know, Mancunian population did we touch in a very different way rather than the people who were already predisposed or pre-converted? I think that's okay to begin with. I think the philosophical question is, does that matter initially? And is it actually equally important to sometimes galvanize your own movement and your own community and get them excited and inspired and feeling like they are working together before taking that message and inspiration elsewhere?
Well, yeah, I know that you mentioned to me that Jamie Kelsey Fry was there and part of what's been going on over the last few days. And I remember getting a voice note from Jamie after we put out our live episode last year. And he was pulling on this thread. He was going, so, you know, this is really great. And who are you talking to? Who are you trying to reach? Like, what language are you using? And I think, like you say, it's not that there's one right answer to that. It's more that you need to know what the answer is. And if you think that you're talking to everyone and actually you're speaking in a language that's only going to make sense to a particular circle, that's when that mismatch is when it gets you into trouble. But I think, I mean, this also pulls on a thread that we've been touching on earlier in this series, which is that question about, you know, make populism good again, that kind of longing to find those things that are worth talking about, those meeting points that do cross there, that do kind of take us out of the ghetto of our own immediate communities and create real meeting points. And I don't think there's a sort of a neat formula for that. I think it's more just a live question that we'll probably carry forward.
I think that's right. And then, you know, and just as an example, I mean, I think we did cross over into, you know, a wider scene. The question is to what degree that happened. I mean, Jamie Kelsey Fry was in the process of, you know, buying tequila in the early hours of Saturday morning in a bunker bar somewhere on the edge of Salford, where I was engaged in a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Psychedelic Pete, who was thanking us all for bringing such an extraordinary curation of content to Manchester. So we did cross some boundaries.
Some boundaries were crossed with the help of Psychedelic Pete. All right, you heard it here first. I'm looking back over my notes from this series and wondering what other loose ends there are to report on. The Bagthorpes. Alfie and I are now on to the 9th book in the Bagthorpe series. We started it yesterday. The 10th book is still eluding us. Thank you to those listeners who have been in touch, who've been trying to track it down for us, especially to Caleb, who actually did find an eBay listing, which unfortunately turned out not to be something that was live and available. Keep looking for us. Bagthorpe's battered. If you've got it in your attic or wherever, there is a reward for the finder. I've told Alfie it might be months or years before we track it down, but it is our shared mission that we share with all of you as listeners to The Great Humbling.
Wonderful.
Another loose thread. The bit about burning a million quid.
Yes.
We had those two episodes where we talked a lot about the KLF and the fantastic John Higgs book. And something in that kind of lit my imagination and connected back to something I was talking about right at the beginning of this series about making good ruins. Mm. And this question of what happens when that starts to turn into almost something worthy of the name of strategy, like an answer to the, okay, what's worth doing starting from here? And I had a call around the time we recorded those episodes with Chris Smage, Small Farm Future guy, and Christopher Brewster, who's also very interested in the future of food. And I was sort of talking to them about this, and I was saying, you know, I think that part of what's at stake in the Making Good Ruins thing is, you know, finding those actors who have significant resources within the existing system, within the existing economy, and who, for one reason or another, are not under an obligation to pretend to make sense according to the logic of that system. And we know we have examples of actors that choose to, for example, spend down their endowments, like the Karen Rasmussen Foundation in Denmark. That's literally a declaration that you no longer believe in the logic of the stock market, what you're meant to be doing with those endowments as a foundation. And instead, you're going to take that capital and over a period of time, spend it down to try to contribute to the possibility of a world that might work on the far side of the failure of the world that we're meant to be in just now. And so I said, you know, I think part of it is actually getting to the point where significant amounts of money can be taken and put into land so that that land is taken out of the market and held in trusts or forms of ownership that allow for the kind of small farm future that Chris is talking about, that allow for, you know, on a wider scale, the kind of thing that Adam Wilson at the Peasantry School is doing, where that's a case of a farm that has literally been bought by a gift, put into a trust to be used in ways that don't fit the logic of the market. And I think that we need to imagine what that would look like if that got really big. And then, like in my notebook, as I was talking to Chris and Christopher about this, I just wrote across a whole page, let's burn $1 billion. Because in a sense, that's what that logic of that strange ritual that Bill Drummond couldn't really understand why he'd done it, and it sort of fried his brain. The logic of it is breaking the logic of money. Mm. And that's what's called for, you know, to take these things that have been turned into objects of speculation and take money, which is going to have been, you know, won by people who are good at playing those games, but who can see the destructiveness of those games and use it in a way that makes as little sense as burning it on a bonfire in order to bring more and more of the world out of the control of those games. And I saw that Carl Feinstein has just published, actually, a little piece that is kind of the seeding of this idea that she spoke to us about in one of the series that we had last year with A School Called Home. And she talked about the idea of creating the Great Letting Go Fund, which is exactly this, you know, taking money that has been won in the casino that we've turned the world into, with the participation of people who can see what that casino world is doing to everyone and everything, and putting it into a fund, the aim of which is to create an off-ramp, to create exit strategies from that whole way of inhabiting the world. And that's very much a loose thread for me. Like, that's not a kind of formulated proposal, but it feels like one of the things that's been running in the background through this series. And I wrote a post that was a kind of how not to do it, that was starting a series on Substack on how we make good ruins. And I feel like that's one of the pieces of work that I'm coming out at the end of this series, needing to carry forward and see where that's leading me.
Yeah, I mean, the burning of the £1 million was the ultimate act of desecration, wasn't it? In challenging all that is perceived as holy in an economic system based on money. It just makes me think, you know, rather than burning £1 billion, if you're going to land bank it in a way that provides an off-ramp and an opportunity for a small farm future, it's more like burying £1 billion.
Right. Ploughing £1 billion into the soil.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Ed, I know you had a piece you wanted to pick up on from episode 7 when we were talking about, you know, our experience as founders, and we got into talking about leadership and whether there is such a thing as humble leadership. And you said something to me after that about zombie leadership. Doesn't sound good, but I want to hear more about that.
Zombie leadership is actually a paper shared with me by my good friend Professor Jonathan Gosling, a great listener of this podcast, and who's been heavily involved with the faculty at the Forward Institute, you know, where I work on responsible leadership. And it's this brilliant paper. It's called Zombie Leadership: The Dead Ideas That Still Walk Among Us. It also introduced me to the word demulcent. Have you ever come across the word demulcent?
No, it sounds, is it something that you would put on a part of your body?
Exactly. You're not far off. This is obviously quite a provocative paper, but I loved in the opening paragraph, they sort of introduce the idea of, like, this is going to seriously annoy a lot of people. But we've also got some demulcent footnotes, and demulcent is to relieve irritation. Which I thought was great.
Well, there
Yeah, we're making some bold statements in this paper, but don't worry, there's some evidence and some footnotes at the bottom which will start to relieve some of that irritation that we provoke. But it's quite a brilliant piece of work. But they talk about zombie leadership as this sort of proliferation of all of these debunked styles of leadership that, you know, are around elite egos. And the vested interests, and what they've sort of described as the leadership industrial complex that sort of manifests itself in a world beyond control. And of course, when you have that notion of control in leadership, you know, you're also then controlling the way of understanding how power and privilege unfolds in the world. And we have this sort of Hollywood idea of leadership, where it's heroic and it's hierarchical, and people need strong leaders, you know, who are special, uniquely talented people, and the success that they achieve is all down to them. And we can recognise all of these because these are kind of archetypes and tropes which are all around us, aren't they? And, you know, the danger that lurks beneath the surface of all of that is that it removes the masses from any kind of decision making. It reinforces those hierarchies and it justifies these notions of superiority, which is one of the reasons why, you know, the fate of Britain in terms of collaboration and imagination was so potent, because it was trying to invert a lot of this. But if you think about the tropes of leadership that, like, really get rolled out all the time, it's like, you know, leadership is all about leaders. You know, those leaders have certain qualities, and there are specific things that all great leaders do. We always recognize a great leader when we see one, and that leadership is is usually quite similar and consistent, or it's a skill held by certain uniquely gifted people. It's always good for everyone, and people just can't cope without leaders. You know, and you get these ideas which are all out there, and even these ideas often infect what we might call enlightened leadership in some of the circles in which you or I move, you know, where people talk about transformational leadership or authentic leadership or ethical leadership or inclusive or distributed leadership. You know, we can even find some of these problematic tropes surfacing in there. And I think what I loved about, you know, this paper was it sort of managed to bring a great degree of clarity on what is happening at sort of meta level in leadership. You know, we have this idea of the spotlit dictator, you know, in a darkened amphitheater, this very visceral image, you know, that you don't see what is going on in the rest of the room because it's all to do with this iconic individual. The risk that has emerged from that is all of this hubris that leaders and leadership industry has, which sort of creates a leadership trap where we've become sort of funneled, a bit like your metaphor you introduced before about the IKEA marketplace, you know, where it's all been funneled to a position where you go, hang on, why have we ended up with a whole bunch of ego-led, narcissistic leaders who we lionize and fetishize and attribute all of the success to, you know, I mean, and literally Donald Trump this week has basically been shouting at the Conservative Political Action Conference, you know, that the one thing that stands between, you know, you all and Armageddon is me, you know, actually deliberately putting himself right there.
It's a comforting thought, isn't it?
Exactly. But the absolute embodiment of zombie leadership. Well, it really is, you know, and I think this is also where we explain this grotesque spiraling of executive pay and inequality that's happened over the last 30 years really just preserves and reinforces this like tawdry, tired, old 19th century elitism. It really entrenches the inequality we already have and just bolsters those traditional centres of power and control. You know, and interesting in the paper, you know, the United States Strategic Command, you know, in the Pentagon in 2011, actually wrote a paper on counter-zombie dominance. Of course they did. And there's a quote from that, which they use in the document, which just says, there is no one-size-fits-all for counter-zombie operations command relationships. So how do we counter this zombie leadership apocalypse, Dougald?
Well, that story about the defense paper makes me think zombies are good to think with.
Yeah.
There's a book circle that started a few years ago here in Sweden around preparations for the zombie apocalypse that became a very, very popular spreading thing, partly because the image of the zombie gives you permission to think about things, which if you conjure them in less fantasy ways, your brain just shuts down.
Yeah.
In the face of the kind of more realistic scenarios. One thing that was striking me as you were talking about that, I mean, obviously, yes, you have Trump as this sort of monster offshoot of the cult of the corporate leader. There's also another version. It's almost like two variants of this zombie leadership can own the space of politics or of social possibility, because the other version is the expert. Because the expert, outside of the appropriate context, once the expert is generalized as the one who knows what to do, and that's the way in which we deal with everything, that also creates another version of the same pattern. And I've been thinking about this because in the book, I picked up on John Michael Greer's distinction between a problem and a predicament. And a lot of people have quoted that back to me, like that's been one of the bits that they found in At Work in the Ruins that's been really helpful for them. And Greer says, you know, a problem is something that has a solution. If it doesn't have a solution, it's not a problem. It's a predicament.
Yeah.
And there are categories of action that make sense in the face of predicaments, but they're not like solutions.
No.
They're not something that if we just do this, it'll make it all go away and we'll be back somewhere that resembles the situation before we notice the problem. Now, what after talking about this a lot last year, what I realized was a problem environment calls for experts. It calls for a technocratic solutionism in which what you do is you get the most knowledgeable, best informed people in a room and they hash it out together and come up with the best solution worth trying. And if that doesn't work, then you try the next solution that people like that come up with. If what we're dealing with is a predicament rather than a problem, then what's called for is far more democratic than that.
Mm.
What's called for is far more distributed. Now, again, quoting Greer, it's dissensus rather than consensus. You want people of goodwill trying different possible responses rather than trying to decide collectively what the right response is. And I feel like that's also part of the DNA of what Jamie Kelsey Fry and others who are involved with hard art are reaching towards, is a recognition that a lot of what we're dealing with, yes, there are situations where what you have genuinely is a problem that needs experts.
Yeah.
But the generalizing of the principle of expert leadership is part of what provokes the response that is then mobilized by a figure like Trump.
Yeah.
And we need to escape from both kinds of zombies. I don't know if that sounds like an appropriate metaphor for the election that's coming up at this autumn in the United States to some people.
No, I was just going to say, I think there's something really, really good about distinguishing about different types of zombie, because that was the other thing that was very powerful at the Fate of Britain, was hearing voices you don't always hear and giving people platforms of participation. The Empathy Museum had created what they called the Ear of Britain, which they'd put on the streets of Manchester the week before the event, recording basically what people wanted to say to the country, their testimonies and the things that the questions they wanted to ask. So there was something beautiful about that. It's like going, this is not a structured poll which is being issued by a political party or a media institution. This is literally an empathic ear for people to express their wishes, desires, questions, frustrations.
I love it. It's making me smile because I remember taking part in a strange gathering at the Danish Parliament I can tell you when it was. It was 8 years ago because it was 100 days before the Brexit vote, because Caroline Lucas was there and she made that point. But it was this political party called The Alternative, started by Uffe Elbeck, the founder of the Chaos Pilots. And they gathered a weird collection of us for 2 days in Copenhagen. And we were sort of brainstorming ideas for like what might actually work, starting from the mess that we're in. And the group that I was with came up with something very similar to that, Era of Britain, and the idea of doing something like that all over Europe. So where I wanted to take this, I mean, it feels appropriate, having done, this is the end of our fifth series, and we did sort of 3 series where we were working at a very fast pace, recording an episode a week. And then we did a 4th series that just got so stretched and drawn out that the episodes kind of lost sight of each other.
Yeah.
And then we've had this 5th series where we've had this interesting tempo of, partly because we've got David Benjamin Blower, who has been doing a sterling job editing these episodes for us. We've kind of put this as a regular appointment in our diaries. And that's maybe something I want to come back to later in this episode.
And we've stuck to it too.
and we've stuck to it. Yeah, well said, Ed. This feels like an appropriate moment to kind of do a bit of a state of the humbling, like to take stock. And firstly, before we turn that into the sort of hyper self-reflexivity, as Vanessa Machado de Oliveira would say, I want to turn that outwards and just look at the state of the landscape of humbling more generally, because I came across something in a Substack post by the theologian Richard Beck, who I think I was put onto by the aforementioned David Benjamin Blower. But he was He was writing the other week and quoting from a recently published study by a scholar called Pelin Kesebir in the field of terror management theory, which I've always been a little bit skeptical about, but it's a whole kind of field of study that assumes that basically all of our sort of social and cultural strategies are really ways of dealing with our fear of death. And this study is called A Quiet Ego, Quiet Death Anxiety: Humility as an Existential Anxiety Buffer. So this made me realize something that hadn't occurred to me before, which is that there is an emerging academic field of humility studies, which is going to create all kinds of issues, given the habits of the ways of speaking and writing and knowing in academia. But according to Pelin Kesebir in this paper, since 2014, the empirical research about humility has exploded. And much of this research has shown that humility functions as a regulating virtue upon which many other virtues depend. So I guess I wanted to bring that because we started this conversation because we both had a sense that talking about humbling, like bringing that to the center, making that a kind of touchstone around which we circle, might be helpful in the moment that we collectively find ourselves in. And so I was struck to realize that before we had arrived at that, that there was a whole sort of field of academics who were arriving at that. And then I read a couple of other posts from someone who's always felt like a kindred spirit of this podcast, Peter Lindbergh, who founded The Stoa. And he quotes from, he talks about a book called Intellectual Humility, An Introduction to the Philosophy and Science by Ian M. Church and Peter L. Samuelson. And they talk about intellectual humility being understood as the virtuous mean between intellectual arrogance and intellectual diffidence. And that's what Peter is trying to invite people towards in Less Foolish, which is his project these days. He talks about observing like both ends of the spectrum, both an intellectual arrogance that is sometimes kind of driving the characters who Nassim Taleb describes as intellectual yet idiot, the IYIs. And on the other hand, the intellectual diffidence of people who have been unnecessarily awed by those kinds of voices, so that we haven't necessarily, I say we, I don't know that this necessarily applies to either of us, but haven't necessarily been given the confidence to make our own judgments rather than need to import wholesale, you know, prepackaged ideas by impressive sounding thinkers. And I think maybe part of what we try and do in these conversations is, you know, weave something unfinished rather than present packages of, if you take on board this very clever sounding bunch of stuff, then you will understand the world and sound impressive when you come out with those things to your friends. But yeah, I was really struck that Peter was talking a lot about humility lately as well. And he said, you know, while stewarding the Stoa, I sensed greater potential in the attendees than in the galaxy brains that we listen to. I see so much potential being bottled up due to the pervasiveness of this intellectual servitude. And maybe the thing that all of this is kind of gesturing towards is what Vanessa in Hospicing Modernity talks about as getting to zero. Modernity has got us all hooked on a game in which you're either up or you're down. You're either plus one or you're minus one. And so everything becomes about trying to clamber up from being a minus one to being a plus one. And, you know, and this is where all sorts of the kind of not necessarily very helpful patterns that we see in our intellectual culture emerge from, you know, the desire to be a plus one in the sense of the sort of narcissism that Peter describes as being the shadow tendency of these people who he was inviting on the Stoa, some of whom get, you know, filed under this heading of galaxy brains, kind of performing this brilliance of, you know, creating a total map of the world the problem we're in, what needs to be done about it. And on the other hand, you know, patterns of cancel culture and the rest of it. And what Vanessa says is what we're looking for is ways to get to zero, ways out of the game of being up or down. Again, it's like exiting the casino, finding the exit ramps from the whole logic that we've been playing within to a place where I become less important and therefore more able to participate in the world and be helpful, rather than treating the world as the kind of snakes and ladders board on which I'm trying to play the game, where I'm trying to be one of the ones who's up rather than one of the ones who's down.
I mean, you had me on an idle daydream for a moment there about, you know, the professor who founds the Humility Institute, you know, and is the only person who could possibly do it because they're uniquely positioned to take this very important message.
World's leading expert in humility.
Yes. So the wonderful paradox of that. And also that there are many ways to leave a casino. You know, you could be thrown out for card counting. You can leave victorious, or you could probably sneak out the back door. I think you're right. I mean, where I got on my reflection, having read the zombie leadership paper, was, and you know, particularly working on responsible leadership with fairly senior people in major institutions, it's obvious some of the stuff which is about the resolution here. It's the fact that, you know, leadership is fundamentally about relationships, and also is only ever really effective where there is an alignment with a connected followership. That the action actually takes place through people, you know, not people being made to do things, but being inspired to want to do things. And so that at its most effective, it is about that collective spirit. And I think humility is absolutely integral to that, you know, and I'm no expert, but I would say that, you know, when you're humble, you set the tone for further humility because you are in service to something. Because you are empowering and working alongside the others around you. You are, as Vanessa would say, in a sense of very grounded realism, not necessarily an optimism, a closely grounded realism. And it's also that territory where making mistakes, owning them, learning together, listening and sharing credit is all part of the mix. So it's like you could say, this hasn't worked. It's not working. We need to try something different. Who else has got a great idea? And in that sense, back to your expert point, it's about not having all the answers. You know, it's the fundamental opposite of the sort of solutionism that comes from problem solving, as opposed to the much more nuanced, delicate, cultural work of navigating predicaments, as you described.
I'm really struck by the way that you were emphasizing relationship there, because I think that brings it back to, well, to something that we talk about a lot. But also, as I've been noticing, once I started to notice how humility was coming up in all sorts of places, then obviously it comes up in more places because that's where your attention is trained. But I was reading Elizabeth Oldfield's forthcoming book, Fully Alive, which it's a really kind of beautiful and moving, and I think it will be for a lot of people a very helpful book. It's her attempt to sort of share the treasures of her deep rootedness in Christianity, not as an attempt to win anyone over or convert anyone, but just to say, I think there are things here that might be useful to everyone, whether or not you're at home with my tradition or can stand within it as a faith. And she uses the, you know, as she says, kind of potentially unpromising framework of the seven deadly sins as a structure around which to weave this. And the last of the sins in the version that she's working with is pride.
Mm.
And she says, you know, I had real difficulty with this one because there are a lot of ways in which we talk about pride that are things that I would not want to regard as a sin at all, but as appropriate, worthy, important things. She says, I think the sin that's being named with pride is the closing yourself off that comes from a sense of self-sufficiency, of not needing anyone else. And then, you know, you get to humility as being one of the opposites of pride. And that points again to this thing of humility as being in relation, and being necessarily in relation, not being, you know, it not being possible not to be in it, and then attending to the quality of it, attending to the kind of relationships, the kind of experiences you're creating for the others who you're in relation with. And I feel like this brings us back to that question of, you know, who are we talking to? Who do we think we're talking to when we get together like this and we have this appointment in our diaries once a fortnight for a season to record these episodes? Ed, who are we talking to?
Well, I think when you and I chatted briefly yesterday, the thing that I was musing on afterwards is that idea of the sort of catch-up culture conversation, because you know, long-term listeners of this podcast will know that you and I swam in similar waters without ever actually speaking for probably a decade or more. And then there was something wonderful about that first conversation we had, which did actually birth this very podcast, because we both had such a kind of enriching and inspiring conversation together, coming from our slightly different perspectives, that was like, oh, we should have recorded that. And I think there's something really in that. So who are we talking to?
I think the first answer to who we're talking to is each other.
Yeah.
And I think the podcast gets better when we remember that. And I think the times when I've felt the life drifting away a little from it have been when we've lost track of that. And so then there's a kind of suspicion that there might be something helpful in creating overheard conversations. Mm. And more generally, maybe underlying that, there's a sense of conversation as a practice, conversation as something that might matter more than it looks like it does, according to the logic of the world that you and I and most of the people listening to this grew up in. And I was thinking about this and remembering a little gathering I was part of in London quite a long time ago now, when Indy Johar and colleagues from 00 were setting up a place called the Hub Westminster. And they invited three of us in for an evening to have dinner and just, you know, share ideas, dreaming what this space that was like one block away from Trafalgar Square, the whole of the first floor of a building that they'd got for a period of time, and what it might be. And I said, I think it would be great if it's a space where really good conversations happen. And I watched one of the other people in the room, I watched his face fall as I said that. And he said, the last thing we need is another talking shop. And ever since, I've felt like those two things name really helpfully a polarity, because I think all of us have experienced coming to something and going, oh no, it's another talking shop. That's a real thing. And I think hopefully all of us have also experienced those kinds of conversations in which something happens, in which something comes alive that leave us changed, or that mark the sort of inception, the conception of something that, you know, that has life in it, that comes alive, that happens, that has consequences. You use that word, consequential. And so, yeah, that thing of catch-up culture, it was Jay Springett, who is one of the originators of Solarpunk. He and I, a bit like you and me, and there's various people, I mean, various people who we name often in this podcast, you know, Liz Slade, Liz Oldfield. You know, there are people who I have regular conversations with one-to-one or in little groups. Some of those conversations are in settings that anyone can turn up to. Some of them are just like a regular appointment in my diary, but we don't hit record like you and I do. And Jay Springett was one of those people. And after two or three times of us having a call every 6 or 12 weeks, he said, oh, you know what this is? He said, It's not cancel culture, it's catch-up culture. And the idea that part of what we're looking for as we try and escape from some of the toxic forms that public discourse has taken might be these overlapping webs of little conversations. I think that's something that I really believe in. And I think especially, you know, frankly, especially for people like you and me, who people who have our demographic attributes, people who show up in our kinds of bodies, have been given lots of platform historically and continue to be so. If we were doing a podcast where we were trying to compete to reach the largest audience possible, if we were like aiming for Jordan Peterson style YouTube figures, I'm not sure that would feel like an appropriate role at this moment in time. I feel much happier having something that, you know, that reaches and matters to a community that's small enough that I feel like I know the names and in some cases the faces or voices of a good proportion of our listeners. And I see that what happens in these recordings, in these conversations, is generative and flows onward and has knock-on effects. So yeah, I guess that's sort of, that would be my answer at this point in time to who do we think we're talking to.
Yeah, and it struck me as you were saying that as well, that the very notion of a talking shop makes it sound transactional as opposed to the relationship-based cultural conversation that with consequences that we might aspire to be having.
There's something here as well that I think it might be possible to push a little further, which is from this notion of conversation as practice, and practice could be in the sense that artists, you know, I remember when I first started hanging out with people who'd gone to art school, I was in my late 20s, I didn't really know that art school was a thing until then, being really struck by the way that they could reflect on their practice. And that could sound a bit precious, but it also gave them a way to put all sorts of things, all sorts of aspects of what they were doing in their lives inside a box of what it was that they were doing that they could consider to be art in a way that was far freer than I'd learnt to think about writing. But practice as well, you know, can be in the sense, well, there's a whole kind of body of thinking about virtue ethics that talks about practice as and being part of a practice as a sort of starting point of that. It's Alistair McIntyre after virtue. So conversation as a practice in maybe both of those senses might also hold a clue to a way of being in the world, which I think, you know, embodies, again, a lot of what you were talking about in terms of what the form of leadership that escapes from the toxic patterns of zombie leadership looks like. And I just finished a book last night by an American journalist, Maura O'Connor, I think her name is. It's a book called Ignition, Lighting Fires in a Burning World, which I'm sure I'm going to be speaking and writing a lot about this book because it's really, really got me thinking. It's basically drawing on her experiences of a year of journeying into training and working as a wildland firefighter, but also setter of fires. And this paradox that, like, part of why America has such horrific problems with wildfires is because it has a landscape that is meant to burn regularly. And for 100 years, that was forbidden in the name of control and more modern forms of management and the traditional folk culture of both indigenous people and earlier generations of settlers who had learnt from their indigenous, at best, neighbours. Often we know that wasn't what the relationship looked like, but that was dismissed because it was old-fashioned, it wasn't scientific. And now, you know, we're into a combination of effects there where it both becomes more dangerous to burn, but also more necessary. And it's an extraordinary book, not least because it's somebody's journey out the far side of the paralysis that the knowledge of climate change can often bring us to. It's an embodiment of a kind of work in the ruins. And by the end of the book, she's describing, like, having a really become part of this practice and developed her skills and trained and worked in all sorts of different parts of the US with this, getting to a point where she's actually having encounters with fire that have a quality of dialogue, have a quality of dance or of conversation. And to me, that's like, that's a glimpse of what, where my trust that there might be more to conversation than meets the eye comes from, is because I think on a good day, we might be practicing a way of showing up, a way of participating in the world that's, you know, that's part of what's going to be called for by the times around and ahead of us. Having recognized that part of why I keep coming back to this, part of why we've gone on and done five series, is that there is something, there is some merit in this form of the overheard conversation. And there are lots of other people who I have conversations with, some of which I wouldn't want to be overheard, because it does change the nature of a conversation to do it, knowing that there's an audience. Yet I'm realizing that I want to bring more of these conversations, more of these friendships and encounters into a setting where it's possible for people to overhear them. So starting in just under 2 weeks' time, I'm going to be doing a fortnightly series of Sunday sessions that are live sessions that you can join for and listen in, and then there'll be a chance to ask questions towards the end of the session, where each time it'll be a different person who I'm in conversation with. I'm going to start with another good friend of this podcast, Caroline Ross, artist and the author of Uncivil Savant on Substack. And each fortnight on a Sunday evening, Swedish time, through till the summer, there'll be a season of these conversations that are open to anyone who's a paid subscriber to Writing Home, my Substack. And then we'll release the, you know, the first part of each one will be released publicly as a YouTube video and podcast. How about you, Ed? What lies ahead for you coming out of the, you know, the unfinished weave of this series into the weeks and months ahead before we, you know, no doubt later this year sit down to begin recording another series of The Great Humbling?
Well, I will be going on writing retreat up in the lakes with Jonathan Gosling and a few participants, where we're going to be visiting William Wordsworth's cottage and having a look through some of the archive manuscripts up there, which I'm very much looking forward to from a poetic sensibility. We're going to be taking the Future Noughts to the Hay Festival, where we're gracing the main stage, which is slightly intimidating, on the opening night, the opening Friday, where we will be doing the Future of Friday Night with our special guest, Amy LeMay, who is London's nightlife czar, which is going to be interesting because London City Hall have actually signed off her participation in the live recording of the podcast with, I suspect, not actually listening to a single episode of the Future Noughts, because usually when somebody says, I just need to check this with my employer, the employer invariably comes back with, you are never going on that podcast. So what could possibly go wrong? So main stage, opening night of Hay, lots of people talking about the Future of Friday Night. And obviously more hard art. Who knows, the fate of Britain might well be replicated in other parts of the country, because I think after that initial success, it would be churlish not to try and draw more people in. And I quite like the idea of the fates, plural, manifesting across the nation and beyond.
Oh, well, listen, Ed, good luck with all of that. Thank you for this series of conversations, and thanks to everyone who's been listening along with us. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We're grateful for all the messages we get from listeners and the other ways you support us, sharing these episodes, spreading the word, and rating them on iTunes and elsewhere. To explore further along the paths we walk in these conversations, subscribe to my Substack, Writing Home, and check out the online series At a School Called Home. You can also find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at Frucool on the platform formerly known as Twitter. The Great Humbling is produced by David Benjamin Blower, and the title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions.